first, and then it had been less funny, but still an adventure, a story to tell. But 130? 164? It was hard to believe. Then they lost their cloud connection. This was like losing a sixth sense, one they used much more than smell or taste or touch. Now the locals were conversing by radio or wire connections. Some view cams were broadcasting by radio, too. Well, it was the same everywhere. Flayed water, whipped rain. There was one camera with a view of the Hudson that was astounding. Waves were slamming into the big concrete dock at Chelsea, after which huge masses of water were shooting vertically into the air, the giant sheets then immediately thrown north. Docks and loose, empty boats floated upstream, some boats foundering, others capsized, others battened down and looking fine, if doomed. Floating docks torn loose looked like lost barges or giant pallets. Vlada wondered how Brooklyn was doing, but didn't bother to look into it. Anything across the rivers was in a different world now. It seemed quite possible everything afloat in New York Harbor would sink or get blown upriver. Idelba's new beach on Coney Island would be well under the surge by now, so possibly the new sand was just down there waiting things out. But it also seemed possible that the sand had been churned by the breakers and cast far north into Brooklyn. Oh well, not the worst of the damage by any means, just another feature of the storm. Idelba herself didn't care. "So many animals are going to get killed," she said. And of course, that made them both think of Stefan and Roberto. They glanced at each other, or nearly, but said nothing. Later, when they were alone, Vlade said, "I'd feel a lot better if I knew where they were."
"I know, but they can find shelter. They know to do that."
"If the surge doesn't catch them off guard."
"Most of the shelter they would take would be taller than that."
This was not necessarily true.
"Roberto is not too good at risk assessment," he said.
Idelba said,
"You have to hope a storm like this would put the fear of God in him."
"Or that Stefan will stop him from doing anything too stupid."
Idelba put a hand to his arm. Vlade sighed. 16 years since she had last touched him. This moment of the storm. The hours passed, the storm kept howling. Vlade spent some time looking for ways to cut more power without making people uncomfortable. He walked the building a few times, and at sunset he stomped back up to the tower to have a look around. It was black up there. He had arrived too late, unless it had looked that way all afternoon, which was possible. The great city was now a mass of rectilinear shadows, enduring under the flail of rain and wind. The south side of the Empire State was no longer a single white waterfall, but it was still crazy-looking, with spray dashing down its central chute and then being blown up on gusts. The western sky was no lighter than the east. It looked like an hour after sunset, though it was actually an hour before. But day was done. It never had managed much on this day. Someone on the radio had said that sometime that night they would be passed over by the eye of the storm. That would be interesting to see from up here. If the eye passed over the center of New York Harbor, the great bay and the eye of the storm might be about the same size. He wanted to come back up here to see if that happened. He wondered if he could power one elevator twice an hour, just to come up here and take looks. Would be nice not to hike the long hall up and down the stairs. Down was harder, or more painful. He was tempted just to lie down and sleep up here. All of a sudden, he was very, very tired. But Idelba came up and got him, and walked him back down to the office, and she slept on a couch there while he crashed in his room, for which he was grateful. 16 years, he thought as he fell asleep. maybe 17 now.
The center of the hurricane passed in the night, and there was the classic lull that occurred at the eye of the storm, audible even from Vlade's bed, in the negative sense that the background roar went away for a while. Barometer reading crazy low, it bottomed out on Vlade's barometer at 25.9. Storm surge possibly rose a bit in the eye, but no way to tell what was causing what. In the night, the clouds came back, and at dawn, NOAA said the other side of the hurricane would be hitting soon. Wind would now come from the southwest and would be strongest at the start, when the eye wall passed over them. So Vlade and Idelba got up and climbed the stairs to the tower again to have a look. At sunrise, the sun blazed in a crack between earth and cloud, looking like an atomic bomb. Then it rose behind the mass of low cloud, and the day went as dark as the day before. Winds quickly grew ferocious, this time coming in from over the Hudson. The change seemed to be some kind of last straw, because buildings all over Lower Manhattan began to fall into the canals. Radio reports came in of people taking refuge in sky bridges, rafts, life jackets, huddling on exposed wreckage or nearby rooftops, swimming to refuge, drowning.
"Damn," Idelba said, listening to a Coast Guard channel. "We've got to do something."
Vlade, focused on the problems of keeping the Met secure, was shocked at the notion that anything could be done.
"Like what?"
"We could take the tug out into the canals and bring people to hospitals or something, either around here or up to Central Park."
"Shit, Idelba, it's crazy out there."
"I know, but the tug is a brick. Even if it sank, it would still be sticking up out of these canals."
"Not in this surge."
"Well, it won't sink. And if we could keep it centered in the canals, we could move a lot of people. Just run around like a giant vapo."
Vlade sighed. He knew Idelba would not let go of an idea once she had it.
"Let's get your guys. Are you sure they'll go for it?"
"Hell yeah."
So they rousted Tabo and Abdul, who said they had already been wondering when Idelba was going to think of this. Then they went down to the utility door under the skybridge to north, where they could get out just above the storm surge, still 15 or 20 feet above the normal high tide. Idelba and her team hauled on the westernmost hawsers until the tug was angled in the canal, and then they could jump down onto its bow and go to its bridge. Even that minute of exposure soaked them, despite their rain gear, and the noise out in the open air was simply stupendous. They couldn't hear themselves even when shouting in each other's ears until they had clawed their way up to the bridge and gotten inside. Even opening and closing the bridge's door was a terrifying endeavor, only possible because they were between the two big buildings. Once inside and with the door closed, shouting worked again. Tabo turned the motors on, and they felt the vibration of them without being able to hear them. So there they were, out in the storm, but navigating something as wide and long as Idelba's tug through the canals was very difficult. The only thing that made it possible was that there were multiple motors and props at both ends of the beast, and rudders, too, which allowed them to push hard in all directions from both ends of the tug. Whether these would be enough to counteract the wind and waves, they would only find out by trying. They motored into the empty Madison Bacino, then turned south with a full effort from Idelba and her guys, all working different motors and rudders, shouting at each other in Berber and just barely getting the tug pointed south. The waves shoved them north, and their stern would have rammed the docks at the north end of the Bacino, but those docks were no longer there. Seemed it was basically a south wind now that they were out on the canals. Heading straight into the wind was easier than turning in it, and they got down the basin and turned left again into 23rd Canal headed east, all at a speed of no greater than 5 miles an hour. They had two things going for them in the city, counterintuitive though both seemed to Vlade. The canals were so narrow and shallow that the water in them could only become a chaos of blown spray and froth without high waves. In effect, the waves were being blown off or smashed flat. Then also, what current there was got channelized by the canals and ran as straight as the Manhattan grid itself. The avenues they crossed had a hard flow from the south. The east-west streets were flowing from the west, or were simply balked and swirling. It was something they could deal with. The tug moved through all this wild water and wind like some kind of hippo or brontosaurus, breasting the shredded water under it without noticeable rocking. Wind affected it more than water, but while they were moving east or west, the buildings buffered the wind, and when they were moving south and north, they were headed either directly into it or directly away from it. So they were only shoved hard in ways that gave them trouble when they were turning in the intersections. Each turn was an experiment and an exercise in screaming Berber. It took all the power of the tug's side jets to keep the bow from being shoved north when they nosed out into an avenue canal. They had to max the bow jets and aft jets both in opposite directions to get the tug to turn. They banged a few buildings with their sides, sometimes hard, but when that happened, the tug then rode its own backwash out toward the middle of the canal, and on they went. Idelba said to Vlade, "Can you go out and help get people on board?" Vlade nodded, took a deep breath, and left the bridge, using the door on its north side. Immediately he was drenched and could hear nothing but the storm. He couldn't hear himself think. Finally, that old saying was really true. So he stopped trying to think, but before he gave up, he stepped into a harness Idelba passed out to him and buckled it tight around his waist. The harness was carabinered and knotted to a rope that was tied to an eye at the front of the wheelhouse, so he was now attached to the tug like a climber to a belay, or a steeplejack to a tower. As they came into the East Village, they saw, as they had not before, that the storm was simply devastating the city. The Wall Street skyscrapers looked okay, and perhaps they even provided some windbreak to the lower neighborhoods immediately north of them. But between the veering winds and the storm surge, the smaller and older buildings north and east of downtown were being overwhelmed. It was as they had heard over the radio and seen when the cloud was up. Buildings were falling down. So people were desperate. They waved to Vlade from broken windows or even lying flat on rooftops, and as the tug motored down second, Vlade indicated left or right, and Idelba and her guys got the tug over next to the buildings, and people jumped onto the tug, sometimes dropping 10 feet or more, which of course injured many of them. Often they climbed up the tug's side ladders from broken windows the tug passed, or from improvised rafts blown downwind onto them. All of the refugees from the storm were soaked and chilled, and many bloodied. There were obvious broken bones and many cuts and bruises, lots of people in shock. It had been a bad night, and yesterday worse, and now the tug represented the first chance these people had seen to get to shelter. The tug had an open deck, but Vlade got people tucked under the high taffrails and sent the worst into the cabins under the bridge, although he didn't like opening those doors. After a while, he ran up to the bridge and yanked the lee door open and crashed back into the big glass-walled room.
"The nearest hospital is Bellevue,"
he shouted to Idelba with unnecessary volume.
"What about up to Central Park?"
"No, it won't be possible to land people there. The street docks will be wrecked."
"Where to, then?"
"Bellevue Hospital is at 26th and 1st, Vlade said.
"Bellevue? Isn't that a mental hospital?"
"Well, NYU Hospital is at 32nd and Park."
"Let's go there."
"For people who aren't hurt, we can just take them back to the Met, or any solid building that will take them. We can do a rectangle like a Vepo."
"Okay."
Vlade leaped back out into the onslaught. In only 10 blocks of going east on Houston, they had picked up a couple hundred people, now filling the deck of the tug, seated and huddled together. Idelba and her guys managed a particularly difficult left turn at Houston and C, extremely exposed, the three of them working the props desperately to keep turning without getting blown too far across the Hamilton Fish Pacino. Having managed that, they rode the wind and canal current up C to 14th, fought through the left turn there and headed into the wind to Park, then turned right up Park and rumbled up to 32nd, where the NYU hospital, looking as crowded as their tug, took in all their wounded people through a north side window on the fourth floor, broken open for that purpose, as it was now the current water level, and there was no other way to get people in. The surge was a big problem, and a big part of every other problem. It was, indeed, a vision of what a third pulse would do, or a nightmare flashback to half a century before. This was what it must have been like, the ground floor underwater, that entire part of the built environment devastated, after which a desperate improvisation to make use of the higher floors. Injured passengers unloaded, they motored on along 32nd to Madison and another wicked left turn there, and after that pushed on in a tough but steady slog directly upwind. Back down to their building, where they could make an easier left turn on 24th, and stop right under the utility door they had used to get on the barge. Vlade had called ahead, and many of the Met's residents were there to help the remaining passengers into the building. When the Sisyphus was empty, Idelba started out into the storm again.
"We'll run out of fuel in about 5 runs, she shouted to Vlade when he came into the bridge.
Their first circuit had taken about 3 hours, so fuel was a problem for the next day, it seemed. Vlade wondered if any fuel depots would still be operating. What would people do without fuel? Batteries couldn't be recharged with the power down. Into the wreckage of Stuyvesant. They couldn't penetrate Peter Cooper Village. Too many of the old towers had fallen into the narrow canals around them. Even out in the largest canals, they often ground onto submerged piles of something and had to back off and try a different way. Any way would do, as everywhere there were people desperate to be rescued. They merely made a single rectangular circuit, and they were full again. The flotsam and jetsam shoving around on the dirty flying foam of the canals now included dead bodies, some of people, but mostly animals, raccoons, coyotes, deer, porcupines, possums. Lower Manhattan had been a lively habitat.
Damn, this is just like that overtopping of Bjarke's wall that Hexter told us about, Vlade said to no one, looking up and down the whitewater canals. The city's getting trashed.
He was on the bridge at this point, but still no one heard him, not even he himself. Or if they did, they didn't bother to respond. Idelba was focused on piloting and on the buildings they were passing. What she saw on her sonar and radar of the canal bottoms was more important to her than any floating wreckage. Save what we can, she said a while later, indicating she had heard him after all. They'll sort it out later. Vlade could only nod and go back outside into the storm to help people get over the side of the tug and into the cabins if they were hurt. While he was down there on the bow deck, holding on hard, helping haul people in from windows they passed, he spotted 2 men swimming together, to their right against the buildings. By standing on an awning frame, they could just make it high enough for Vlade to help boost them up and over the side. They saw this and got on the awning. The tug was headed west on 29th and about to turn south on Lex, so Idelba was running as far to the right as she could already to make more room to fight through the left turn. Just as Vlade was leaning down to grab the hands of the reaching men, a big wave caught the tug from the left, possibly a surge from a fallen building, anyway, massive. It cast the tug right into the building at the corner, crushing the two men between tug and wall with a palpable thump. The tug held there against the wall, and Vlade, who had jerked up just in time to get clear of the collision himself, looked up at Idelba and screamed at her to turn left, waving his arms desperately. He saw through the bridge's windshield that she had seen what had happened and was spinning the wheel and gunning the jets to turn left. He could feel the vibration of the motors under him, fighting the wind. Finally, the tug heaved away from the wall, water sluicing into the growing gap between it and the building. Vlade looked down. The two men were gone. He was startled not to see their crushed bodies floating on the water, but no, nothing. Only two streaks of blood on the wall of the building, right above the slapping waves. It occurred to him that bodies with the air squashed out of their lungs might have lost enough buoyancy to sink like stones. Apparently so. Anyway, there was no sign of them. Just those smears of blood. He twisted away and leaned over the bow, feeling sick. When he had mastered his features, he turned and looked up at Idelba. She was staring down at him with a horrified look, gesturing to ask what was up, if she should stop the tug. He shook his head, pointed south. "Go!" he shouted, and waved at her to make the left turn and head down Lex. "But what about those men?" she indicated, pointing and asking something. He shook his head again. No one to save. When Idelba understood him, her face contorted, and she looked away. A few seconds later, the tug's motors kicked in, and it struggled through the left turn onto Lex and ground its way south into the wind and waves. Idelba stared downtown, her face like a mask. Through the rest of that day, they managed three more circuits. Then darkness fell, and they agreed it was too dangerous to be out and about. But then, as they were headed for the Met, the wind subsided to a mere gale, maybe 30 miles an hour, Vlade guessed. So Idelba kept them going, the tug's super-powerful nightlights glazing the immediate vicinity like a welder's torch. By their lurid illumination, they made two more circuits, after which they were out of fuel. Never did the number of people needing rescue lessen. They dropped off the injured at NYU Hospital until it was bursting at the seams. Then they were directed to the Tisch Hospital on First, and on the circuit after that, to Bellevue. That was good in some ways, as it made for a shorter run and saved fuel and time. By the time they called it quits, they had put a couple thousand people into the hospitals, Vlade reckoned, and another 1,000 into the Met. There was room in the building for that many people, of course, as long as they didn't have to have actual beds. And on that night, a dry floor was enough. Residents brought down extra blankets and did what they could. For sure, their food and water supplies would now quickly run out, but that was going to be true everywhere, so there was nothing to do but give people shelter and see what happened. It was said that Central Park was being used as a refugee camp, that many people now homeless were taking refuge in their big park. It was a case of finding ground higher than the surge and waiting out the storm.
"Damn, I wish I knew where those boys were," Vlade said as he was falling asleep on his bed,
Idelba out on the couch in his office. He had seldom been more tired. And as far as he could tell, Idelba had fallen asleep the moment she hit the couch, wet hair and all.
"They'll be okay," she said dully.
And then Vlade was out. The next day, it was still windy and raining hard, sometimes pelting down, but all within the norms of an ordinary summer storm, drenching, cool, blustery, but compared to the 2 days before, not very dangerous and much better lit. White-gray rather than black-gray. Also the tide, though the dawn began with a high tide, was no longer a storm surge. It was down to only a couple feet higher than an ordinary high tide. Now, on the buildings around Madison Square, there was a faint bathtub ring of leaves and plastered gunk, much higher than the usual high tide mark. The surge had apparently already poured back out the narrows and through Hellgate into the Sound. It had to have been one hell of an ebb run. Vlade could now get back into his boathouse, and so he unsealed the door to it and began to sort out the confusion created by having all the boats floated up into each other, and in some cases crushed a bit against the ceiling. Many of them were internally flooded by this, but oh well, could be pumped out and dried out. Getting the boathouse sorted took half the day, and after that he could go out in the Met runabout and inspect the building and the neighborhood. The canals were everywhere filled with flotsam and jetsam, pieces of the city knocked loose and floating around. People were back out on the water, although the vapos were not running yet. Police cruisers zipped around ordering people out of their way, stopping to collect floating bodies, animal or human. The health challenges were going to be severe, Vlade saw. It was already warm again, and cholera was all too likely. The freshets of rain that came that day were a good thing in that sense. The longer it was before the sun hit the water and began to cook the wreckage, the better. Idelba's tug now served as a good passenger ferry up Park Avenue to Central Park, where there were some new jury-rigged docks, very busy with lines of waiting boats, most of them unloading people from downtown. The glimpses into Central Park that they got before they returned down Park were shocking. It looked like all the trees in the park were down, which seemed all too possible, and at the moment was not their problem, but it made an awful sight. They returned to the Met and took a last load of refugees out of the building, ignoring the occasional protester, telling them the building was maxed and more than maxed, and Central Park was now becoming the better place for them to get shelter and refugee status.
"Also, we're out of food," Vlade told them, which was close enough to true to allow him to say it,
and it worked to get people to leave. Inspector Jen had been out working since the storm began, but she had come back home the night before on a police cruiser to change clothes and catch a couple of hours of sleep. Now she asked for a ride up to Central Park, where her people said she was needed again.
"I believe it," Idelba said. "Won't be long before New Yorkers start to riot on you, right?"
"So far so good," the inspector said.
"Well, but it's still raining. They can't get out to protest yet.
When it stops raining, they will."
"Probably so, but so far so good." Vlade had never seen the inspector look as tired as she did now, and this was just the start of it. What was she? 45? 50? Around the same age as him, he thought. Police work was tough, even on inspectors.
"You'd better pace yourself," he said to her. "This is going to be a long haul."
She nodded. "How did the building do?"
"Held up fine," Vlade said. "I haven't had the chance to check it all out yet, but I didn't see anything horribly wrong either."
"Did the farm shutters hold?"
"Jesus," Vlade said. "I don't even know."
When they dropped off the inspector and the last load of their building's refugees, some of whom were grateful, but most of whom were already focused on their next problem, they turned around and headed back down to the building. When Idelba dropped him off, he hiked up the stairs as fast as he could and got to the farm floor huffing and puffing and shoved the door out to have a look.
"Ah, shit."
The farm floor was thrashed. Only a few storm shutters remained in place, ironically on the south wall. The rest were gone, a few remaining flat on the floor among fallen hydroponic lines, broken vegetables, tipped boxes, and so on. The massive steel posts at the four corners and every 25 feet across the exterior walls were revealed in all their strength. The central elevator core remained. Aside from that, it was a wreck. The wooden boxes of soil that had been bolted down were still in place, but all the rest were tipped over or shoved across the floor to the north railing, their crops ripped out of them. Luckily, they had gotten about half the planter boxes inside the halls of the floor below, but aside from those, they would have to start over. Which, as it was already June 27th, was bad news in terms of food self-sufficiency. Not that they had ever been self-sufficient. The farm had always provided only a modest percentage of their food, from about 15% in summer to 5% in winter. But this summer, it was going to be much less than that. Oh well, at least the building had held, and no one in it had died, as far as he knew. And the animal floor had held like every other floor but the farm, so their animals were okay. If Roberto and Stefan came back in safe and sound, all would be well. So the farm was a bit of a luxury problem. Vlade stumped back down to the common room and shared the news. For a while he sat there, eating reheated stew and thinking things over. Then he sought out the young finance punk, the Gar.
"Hey, when the rain stops," he said to him, "would you take your hydrofoil out there and have a look for the boys?"
"What?" Franklin exclaimed. "They weren't here?"
"No, they got caught out fooling around, and they left their wrist pad behind so we couldn't track them."
"Brilliant."
"Well, you know them. Anyway, Gordon Hexter says they were going up to the Bronx to see if they could steal Melville's gravestone."
"Fuck, the Bronx will be a mess."
"As always. But if they hunker down up there, they should be okay. I'm just worried about them is all. They're almost certain not to have taken any food or water with them, or warm clothing, for that matter."
"Fuck."
"I know. Will you do it? I'd go, but I've got to see to things here."
"I'm busy, too," Franklin exclaimed. But then he saw Vlade's look and said, all right, I'll go have a look. Why break my streak with these guys?"
All life is an experiment. Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr.
B. Inspector Jen. Jen got the call, like every other officer in the tri-state area. Emergency, all hands on deck. In her case, she was told to stay in her immediate vicinity during the storm itself, which she did. Then the day after the hurricane had passed, she was directed by headquarters to Central Park, and she joined a big cruiser of water cops in a run up to the tide dock on 6th. The storm surge had washed right up into the southeast end of the park, they were told by the cruiser's pilot, such that waves had been crashing into the pond and overrunning the Woolman ice skating rink. Farther west, the 6th Avenue dock, a long thing that floated or lay on the avenue as the tides dictated, had had to be recovered and flipped back right side up before it could be redeployed down 6th again, where it went back to rising and falling at the high end of the intertidal. Again, boats were docking at its south end and unloading people and goods to move north over the dock to dry land. The need for it was so great that the cruiser carrying Jen had to wait its turn, and then they all disembarked in a hurry. Walking up into Central Park, Jen was amazed by what she saw. First, the crowd. The park was packed with people. It was like nothing she had seen before. Second, they were all standing in some kind of open field. The trees were gone. Not gone, exactly, but down. All down. Most had been knocked down roughly northward, either broken off at the trunk or tipped out of the ground, with their roots torn up, and the muddy root balls facing south like splayed hands. Some trunks were still standing, but were broken at their tops, snapped, or splintered off at some height or other, relieving the pressure of the wind and allowing the trunks to stay standing, like useless poles among their fallen fellows. The devastation of the trees made the park a less than satisfactory refuge, but it was what they had, so people were there. Some part of the crowd, uninjured and looking for things to do, had begun to collect broken branches and pile them into big stacks of broken wood. The smell of torn leaves and splintered wood filled the humid air. This cleanup was itself a dangerous business, resulting in new injuries, because the ground was saturated and the downed trees and fallen branches were heavy. Jen listened to the police officers already on hand and took their point. The first order of business was to get the crowds who were doing cleanup work to consider their own safety and desist. The groups were self-organized, however, and full of energy, having survived the storm and the devastation of their park. They did not necessarily take kindly to police trying to quell or even organize their activities. It was a New York crowd, and so it took diplomacy to walk around asking people not to be a danger to themselves. "We've had enough injuries already," Jen said over and over. "Please don't add more now." Then she would either put her shoulder under a branch if there was a need and some room for her, or move on to the next cluster of workers to discuss it with them, or crouch with sitting survivors to ask how people were. It was heartening to see people mostly calm and semi-organized. She had heard of it. She had seen it at smaller scales from time to time. But never had she seen anything like this, where it looked like the entire population of the city had flooded into Central Park. It meant that essential services were overwhelmed, no doubt about it. Nowhere near enough water, toilets, food. Lines for park toilets were long, and the sewers were going to be overwhelmed, the surge having backed them up anyway. The park itself would become the toilet. Problems were going to rapidly mount for a week at least, and probably longer, depending on how relief efforts went. Beyond that obvious set of problems, it was a matter of recovering from seeing the park so devastated. The rest of the city must be similarly thrashed. But to see not a leaf left on a standing tree anywhere, to see every single tree broken or down, it was shocking. They were going to have to start from scratch when it came to restoring the place. In the meantime, it looked like a bomb had gone off somewhere to the south, some kind of concussive blast knocking everything down without a fire. Many wild animals were dead, and their bodies would have to be disposed of as soon as possible. For now, they were being piled beside some of the giant piles of broken branches. Then also, injured people kept arriving, and these were helped or carried to the aid stations. Certainly, there was lots of help for stretcher carries. People were milling about, looking for ways to be a help. But what about water? What about toilets? What about food? Jen got on the wrist with headquarters and made the same reports and requests as everyone else, judging by the responses she got. "We know," they kept saying. "Are the feds coming?" Jen asked. "They say they are." Jen went over to the Woolman ice rink, where it seemed like they should be able to clear an area big enough for even the largest helicopters to land. It had indeed been flooded by the surge, which was amazing. But now the waters had receded, and it was left muddy, with a shallow pool filling the rink area. Actually, with the trees gone, helos could land anywhere once an area was cleared. Airships could tie off on the towers at Columbus Circle, and indeed all around the park. A lot of airship traffic could be accommodated, which was good, because all the bridges to the island were out of commission. The George Washington Bridge had survived, but the causeway to the west of it crossing the Meadowlands Bay had been flooded and was wrecked. For a while, they were going to be a true island again. Water would be okay, if they got a helicopter or two of life straws. These came in kitchen and personal sizes, and by using them, they could drink and cook using the water taken from the park ponds, or even the rivers. Life straw filters were a wonder. Food was still cached in restaurants and stores and apartments around the city, presumably. They would need more, but drops could be made, and ferry trips, as to any other disaster site. Same with medical aid. So in fact, the hardest problem might be toilets. As she reported to headquarters, We know, they said. As she wandered the park, doing what she could, Jen started making lists in her head, redundant lists, as obviously the various emergency services already had them, but she couldn't help herself. Beyond that, she just helped people who asked for help. She answered questions. She took reports concerning some petty crimes. Very few, she was pleased to note, and the complainants themselves, often none too reliable, she judged. Mainly, she helped by her presence to create the sense of an orderly space. Police were still walking the beat, protecting and serving where necessary. Would eat offered food. New York was still New York. But what a devastation. She saw, face after face, distraught and red-eyed. Here, a young blonde child crying that she had lost her parents. Here, a heavyset Latino man, confused and maybe demented, mouth hanging open, startling blue eyes, looking for something he could recognize. Here, a skinny black man with dreadlocks, holding one forearm with the other hand, and grimacing. Here, a weasel-faced white youth, dancing in place and singing a song written on his wrist pad. People were lost, had lost other people, were in shock. She had to go to that police officer's place of disassociation. Easy for her, most of the time. A bit harder today. But it was a big place in her, and she was comfortable there. Every day in a police officer's life was a succession of disasters, so now that the city had been crushed, it was like, hey, people, welcome to my world. I know this psychic space. Let me guide you. Let me help you. It is possible to live here without freaking out. It's possible to stay calm and cope. Believe me. Do it like me. She slept at the precinct house at West 82nd because it would have taken too much time to get back down to the Met, and she was beat. It was beginning to register that with the Skybridge network in disarray, she was going to have to get used to getting around Lower Manhattan on police cruisers, or the Vapos when they started running again. The city felt bigger. She fell asleep on a bench and woke up before dawn, sore and cold. Looked out the door, it was pre-dawn, but the rain had stopped. She went to the bathroom, which worked, she was pleased to see, and then walked outside and down into the park on the 65th Street transverse. People were stretched out everywhere, on plastic bags, under blankets and sleeping bags, under the occasional tarp or tent, but mostly exposed to the night. Luckily, with the storm past, they were back to the usual steamy midsummer heat and humidity. That would make for problems of a different kind. But in terms of getting through the night, it was a good thing. It was strange to see people sleeping outdoors on the ground together, their sleeping faces dim in the late moonlight. A vision from an earlier age. Then the sun was up, and people were sitting around smoky little fires looking stunned and dirty. They were finding out that green wood didn't burn well. It was against the law to have fires in the park, but Jen waved at them. Nature would put those fires out soon enough. Or people with gas would get them going hot enough to burn something. Could cremate dead animals. People would be a danger to themselves. Helicopters as big as tugboats began to chomp in and land near Woolman, and on the meadows at the north end of the park. Blimps were now filling the sky, as usual, but more than usual, either bringing relief or trying to get images for news programs, or both. Jen kept doing the work of a beat cop, and there were definitely more problems to conciliate, more petty crimes reported. They were shifting out of emergency mode into the phase of stupendous hassle, at which point people would get irritable, more prone to argument and complaint and fighting. This she had seen many times before, even with crowds leaving an entertainment event. People were now ready to leave this event too, getting anxious to leave, in fact. But they couldn't. The show was still on, and that was just the kind of obstruction that set certain people off. So she spent the day mediating, directing traffic, shooing away sightseers. Go back uptown, she directed to people who looked like uptowners, identifiable by their fresh look. She hated looky-loos, but impersonally. In this case, they were a sign that eventually the city would probably come through this all right. In the depth of the hurricane and the immediate aftermath, this had seemed questionable. The storm, a true crisis. Now it was becoming just another fucking disaster. But it had to be gotten through. So she got through that day, and then another. At the end of that day, she took a cruiser back down to the Met and collapsed. Vlade awarded her a shower. The day after that, she was ordered back to Central Park. After that, she was put on boat patrol in Lower Manhattan, cruising the canals and helping the drowned city. This turned out to be ugly work. There were bodies floating in the canals. That was the first priority, and a gruesome, unhappy one it was. Bloat and stink were setting in. People of all apparent ages had been killed, either drowned or hit by flying debris, it looked like. Then also, animal bodies, less gruesome because of their fur, less unhappy because they were animals. Navigation had to be reestablished, first in the avenues and big cross canals, then the east-west regular canals. For quite a few of them, clearing a passage wasn't possible in the short term, as buildings had fallen across them. But the police had to sort out what was possible and what wasn't, and establish detours, and talk it over with the MTAs. She was in charge of one big cruiser for the whole of the fifth day after the storm, patrolling Chelsea and the West Village, picking up refugees and clearing debris, and now, depressingly, keeping out looters when she came on a low, fast motorboat with an odd look at 7th and 13th. She ordered them to stop by yelling at them with the bullhorn on the cruiser bridge and brought her crew to high alert when she saw how the people on the boat were armed and seemed to be considering whether to obey her or not. Then they did stop, and she boarded them with her people covering her. "What are you doing?" she asked. The captain of the boat, or the man in charge, patted his pad and showed her their papers. A private security firm, RNA, which stood for Rapid Non-Compliance Abatement.
"We've been hired to patrol the neighborhood here."
"By who?"
"The Neighborhood Association."
"Which one?"
"Chelsea Townhouse Association."
Jen shook her head. "There is no such association."
"There is now."
"No, there isn't. Who are you working for?"
"The Chelsea Townhouse Association."
"Give me your ID and your working papers." The man hesitated, and Jen gestured to her team, and four more officers leaped over the sides of the boat, holstered guns prominently displayed. Tasers, but still, they were armed. The men on the RNA boat were also armed. Everyone stood there looking serious. Jen, the only woman on the boat, also the person in charge, kept a straight face, kept it professional and polite. Polite, but firm. Maybe more firm than polite. She sat down with the man and slowly put him through his ID paces. His security firm, Rapid Non-Compliance Abatement, had apparently been hired by a neighborhood group that called itself the Chelsea Townhouse Association. They occupied the buildings on the 28th block and were worried because so many buildings around them had been wrecked by the storm. They might have become an association very recently. They needed to protect their investment.
"Investment," Jen repeated.
She tapped around on her pad, looking for links, and tapping a note to Olmsted and asking him to do the same. She was finding nothing when Olmsted got back to her. RNA is owned by Escher Security. Both do work for Morningside.
"We're private investment security,"
the man explained when Jen looked up at him. "You sure are."
"We're on your side. We help you out."
"Maybe so," Jen said. "But we're in an unusual situation here, and we don't want any militia-type actions. We've got enough trouble. We're going to want to talk to the people who hired you. So just give me their contact info, and we'll go from there. And this area
is off limits right now. What is this, martial law? This is New York, and we're the New York Police Department. Ordinary law still holds. She took photos of all their documentation and got back on the police cruiser, thinking hard. She gave Sergeant Olmstead a call. Hey, Sean, thanks for that. How did you find that connection between RNA and Escher so fast? I've been looking into Escher pretty closely. They are definitely Morningside security, and they clone subsidiaries to work on various Morningside projects. So RNA is one of those. The guy you talked to on that boat is actually on the Escher personnel list. I see. So you know who else used to work for Escher? Three of the people now working at the Met Tower for Vlade Maravich. Su Chen, Manuel Perez, and Emily Evans. They all worked for Escher, and they all left that off their resumes when they applied for the jobs at the Met. They all said they worked for one of the more distant clones. Out of the arms of the octopus, you know? Okay, Jen said. Maybe you've found the infiltration that made it possible for them to disable the cameras when they snatched Mutt and Jeff.
I think so.
And Morningside has worked with our lovely mayor.
Right.
And also with Angel Falls, that's the Cloisters guy, Hector Ramirez. Morningside is a really big octopus, and so is Ramirez. And I can't get into either of their files. I've been trying, but the cloning makes it hard. In fact, it looks to me like Morningside taught the octopus method to Escher. Heck, Escher may be just one of the arms of the Morningside octopus, probably just closer to the body. Okay, keep detaching the suckers on those arms. Look in particular for who made the offer on the Met.
What a ruin it will make, exclaimed H.G. Wells on first seeing the Manhattan skyline.
C. Franklin. So I'm thinking, I've got the smallest boat in Manhattan, and I'm the one going out after the biggest storm of all time to hunt down two crazy kids with a death wish? Really? But it wasn't just Vlade asking me in his heavy Slavic mafia way, gravid or even morbid with the responsibility for all the creatures in his ark, including, yea, the littlest and most stupid among them. It was also Charlotte, and the way she put it was galling but ultimately effective. It will give you something to do, she said. The stock market is closed. The stock market, I scoffed, as if that matters. Yeah, well, what are you going to do on a day like this? Trade bonds? It's a holiday, Frank, my boy. Go out and have some fun. Should be very exciting for your little speedboat. Things get too tough out there, you can turn into a submarine or a mini blimp, right? And besides, those kids may need help. Very exciting for you. Yeah, right. But then she just gave me a look with her little smile and flicked me away like a mosquito. I have to get to work, she said. Let me know how you do out there. I made a heavily impositioned sigh and went to my room to get my heavy weather gear. Great stuff from Eastern Mountain Sports. Vlade pulled my bug down from the rafters and glowered me out the door. I was pleased to get out, of course, and didn't want Charlotte to think I was unwilling to help. And in fact, the day was a stunner. Blustery day under clouds like tall galleons crashing on shore under full sail. The canals all cappuccino with foam, the East River a chaos of blue and brown chop, lined by spume and wakes. I ran up the northward fast lane in the East River, or where it had used to be, the buoys having been mostly torn away. There was much less traffic on the river than usual, and I pushed to full speed, and the bug lifted onto its foils, and we flew. There was enough chop to make it a challenge. I definitely didn't want to get launched into the air and come down hard enough to purl like a surfer on a longboard, tipping the boat into an ass-over-tea-kettle capsizing. Worth taking some trouble to avoid that one, so I throttled down a bit past Roosevelt Reef and under the big east side bridges. Not record time by any means, but soon I was taking a left up the Harlem River, where I goosed back down into the flood and hummed along like an ordinary citizen. On my left, the drowned part of Uptown was looking bad. Of course it never looked good, sitting under the great spine of towers from Washington Heights to the Cloister Cluster. Harlem, a bedraggled bay with some islanded towers sticking out of it, the shallows occupied with old buildings tipped this way and that, and now seriously pummeled by the storm. Possibly if they knocked it all down and replaced it with raft blocks, as in my development plan, it could become a decent adjunct to the Cloister Cluster. Yes, it was Robert Moses time in Harlem. And maybe everywhere. The Bronx looked even worse than Harlem. It had never looked good, of course, and the hurricane had swept over Manhattan and struck it right in its sorry, cratered face, shoving big breakers far up into the waterways and valleys, no doubt, where they had pounded for 3 days. Now, with the storm surge receded, it looked like a tsunami had rolled in and out, but not all the way out. Utter estuarine devastation. I poked up the long, narrow bay filling the Van Cortlandt Parkway, west of the Bronx River Channel. This was the easiest water route to get to Woodlawn Cemetery, where the boys had supposedly been headed. Uprooted trees looked like dead bodies on the land. Floating trees looked like dead bodies in the water. The Bronx? No thunks. The sad borough was big, dead, killed. I nosed around in narrow flooded streets that somehow did not rise or sink to the level of canals, letting off my air horn from time to time in case the boys were still tucked into a shelter somewhere and didn't see me. I didn't see why they would do that on a nice day like this, but I tried it anyway. There were a lot of buildings still standing enough to have served as shelter for them, big concrete boxes with broken roofs. Indeed, as the day wore on, it became clear from the sheer size of the borough that looking for any one pair of boys was a futile gesture. Pointless, and yet something that someone had to do. Someone, not necessarily me. There were so many ways that the storm could have killed them that I wondered if we would ever know. Drowned, most likely, of course, that being their specialty. Or crushed, second most likely. Bold but stupid. They would have made good traders someday, but oh well. You have to survive your crazy youth to be able to deliver on the promise inherent in that craziness. A call came to my wrist from Charlotte. Hey, Frankie boy, they turned up back at the Met.
No way.
Way. Well, that's good news. I was never going to find them up here. Especially with them not being there. Right, but even if they had been, this is one big fucking wreck of a place. Always true. Should I pick you up on my way home? Do my Boy Scout good deed for the day? Help old lady cross street? No, I've got to deal with some shit here. Some really shitty shit. Okay, good luck. And I backed the bug out of a particularly nasty canal, more or less coated with the floating bodies of little furry creatures drowned in the flood, sad to see, but not as sad as it would have been if our two rebels without a cause had been there among them. And small mammals are usually very reproductive. Ineradicable, really. So I saluted the musky, stinky dead as I turned, and got myself back down the flooded streets to the narrow bay and then the Harlem River. There I shoved the throttle forward and flew down the flood like a bird, a shearwater to be specific, skimming the waves back toward home. Glorious flight. Back at the Met, I joined the small crowd in the dining hall surrounding the boys, who were stuffing themselves as if they had the proverbial hollow leg. They looked up at me like raccoons peering out of a dumpster, and I had a sudden vision of them belly up in the Bronx with their furry brothers and sisters.
What the fuck? I said. Where were you guys?
Glad to see you too,
Roberto mumbled through a mouthful of something. Stefan swallowed and said,
Thanks for looking for us, Mr. Gar. We were up in the Bronx.
We knew that, I said. Or we thought we did. How about you carry your wrist pad with you from now on? They both nodded as they continued to eat. I stared at them. They looked starved, but otherwise fine.
thoroughly untraumatized. I had to laugh. You must have found a place to hide, I said. Stefan swallowed again and drank deeply from a glass of water.
We couldn't get back to Manhattan because the waves got too big.